Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited today to be speaking with Richard Heinberg. Richard Heinberg is a professor of human ecology at New College in Santa Rosa, California. And he has written some really great books. The last one, The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. So this is a very, very important book. It's very well written. I highly recommend it because people need to have this information, and it's a fun book to read. Very, really interesting. The party's over. So let's talk about the problem and talk about the solutions, because it's definitely a big one. So welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Sue. Good to be talking with you.
Would you explain about the peak oil? And most people don't seem to understand that we are already running out of oil. It's not in some like 1,000 years or something like that, but very soon. I guess that's a sort of a controversial issue, and you think it's already on the downside.
Right. Well, usually when people look at oil, they think in terms of how much we have in the ground right now, which is a tremendous amount. It's about 1 trillion barrels. Nature gave us about 2 trillion barrels to start with, and we've used about 1 trillion barrels so far. They think, well, you know, we should look at the current rate of use, which is about 25 to 30 billion barrels per year, and divide 1 trillion by 25 or 30 billion, and that tells us we have 40 years left. But actually, that's not the right way to look at it, because it's physically impossible for us to continue extracting oil at the rate we are right now, just because of the geology. As the petroleum geologist M. King Hubbert realized back in the 1950s, oil production from any given well or reservoir tends to follow a kind of bell-shaped curve. When you have extracted about half of the resource, it becomes more difficult to continue extracting. And so the oil production peaks. Now, we've already seen this happen in the United States. Oil production in the U.S. peaked in 1970, and it's been on the downslope ever since then. And actually, that was one of the most important economic events in U.S. history, because that, well, before that time, the U.S. was the world's foremost oil producer, world's foremost oil exporter, actually, for much of the 20th century. We were the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century, and our oil production peaked. That means ever since then, we've had to import more and more of our oil to sustain our lavish American way of life. Well, there are about 44 significant oil-producing countries in the world, and of those 44 countries, somewhere between 25 and 30 are already past their peak of production. And this is interesting. You know, I've been following this subject for several years now, and it's kind of a grim game, actually, that you can play, just watching the production figures month by month, watching one country after another go past its peak of production. Just this year, we'll probably see 2 or 3 more countries pass their peak of production. So sooner or later, the world as a whole has to pass its peak of oil production. And that date is not that far off. Estimates vary, but it's likely to be sometime within the next 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that maybe a lot of listeners are realizing that a lot of the war that's going on now, that is the United States, there's some people in the world trying to grab the resources that are left before they run out altogether. But I don't think that most people realize how long this has been going on. I think there was a sentence in your book that said that foreign policy has been based basically on getting resources, especially oil, forever in the United States, forever, not being that long, and that it's not that old a country.
Right. Well, just in the 20th century, the World Wars I and II were fought and won largely about oil. World War I was the first war fought with oil, battleships running on oil rather than coal for the first time, and new inventions like the airplane and the tank. Germany tried to get oil from Romania. The Allies, Britain and France, were able to get oil from the United States, which again was the world's foremost oil exporter at that time. And so shipping across the Atlantic supplied 7 out of 8 barrels of oil used by the Allies during the war. Germany was prevented from getting oil from Romania and basically ran out of gas. Same thing happened in the Second World War. Germany tried to get oil from Russia, which during the 20th century was actually, for much of the 20th century, was the world's second foremost oil producer. So the rivalry between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the 20th century was also a rivalry between the world's foremost oil-producing country and the world's second foremost oil-producing country. Mm-hmm. Well, Germany, of course, was prevented from getting oil through the Soviet Union and again ran out of gas. Meanwhile, Japan had been dependent on the U.S. for oil. Prior to 1941, the U.S. was unhappy about Japan's attempts to establish an empire in the Pacific, cut off oil supplies in 1941, and Japan retaliated by attacking Pearl Harbor and simultaneously attacking the Dutch East Indies, which was the foremost oil-producing region of the Pacific. Well, with submarine warfare, the U.S. was able to cut off supplies to Japan, and by the end of World War II, Japanese ships didn't have enough fuel to undertake evasive maneuvers, and Japanese planes didn't have enough gasoline to take off from aircraft carriers, drop their payload of bombs, and get back to the aircraft carriers. So they invented a new form of warfare, the kamikaze mission, which only required half as much fuel. So oil has been important to warfare all through the 20th century. And every war in the Middle East is essentially about oil to one degree or another, because that's where the oil is. And outside powers like the U.S. and Britain and France have had interests in the Middle East throughout the 20th century and into the new century. And the only reason that these countries are interested in the Middle East is because that's where the resources are. And oil, we have to remember, is the lifeblood of industrial society.
And of war. Isn't most of the, I heard a huge percentage of oil is actually used by the military. So it's used up. It's when you're saying it's transported, it's used up to get more oil.
That's right, yeah. The U.S. military isn't all that concerned about fuel efficiency in its vehicles. Many of the vehicles and planes used by the military, you know, guzzle oil at just an incredible rate. But that's okay because, of course, the whole purpose of the military is to acquire more resources anyway. So I guess the investment is well worth it from their perspective.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, so that covers a part of your book here, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. We just talk about oil war. And so what about the fate of industrial societies? I was just talking to my friend this morning in New York, and we're here in California, and she's saying, well, she's going to come visit me in a couple years. I said, well, you better hurry up before the oil runs out. And, of course, you know, she laughed. I'm sure she doesn't take it seriously.
Yeah. Well, actually, this is a very serious concern, because the two sectors of the economy that are most dependent on oil are agriculture and transportation. These are absolutely essential to our modern way of life. Agriculture, of course, because we use oil to fuel tractors, and also we use natural gas to make fertilizer from. And we transport food ever further distances. The average food item on our plate has traveled 1,300 miles to get there, and that's 1,300 fossil fuel miles. Transportation, not only do we put oil refined oil in the gas tanks of our cars, but we literally run on top of oil. The roads are made from it. They're made from asphalt, from bitumen. And the planes we fly, of course, run on kerosene, which is refined from oil. And really, theoretically, there are alternatives for running our cars. We could have electric cars. Of course, we'd have to have a lot more electricity in order to do that, but theoretically we could have electric cars, but there aren't that many other choices for road building or for airplanes. What besides kerosene can we put into the gas tanks of our fleet of jet airliners? Well, theoretically we could do hydrogen, but of course we'd have to make a lot of hydrogen, which is another subject. But also we'd have to redesign the planes because those gas tanks would have to be much larger. We'd have to reproportion the planes, and it turns out that the right size plane to run on hydrogen is about three times the size of a 747. And those planes aren't on the drawing boards right now. Boeing isn't making them. So my prediction is that as oil production peaks and begins to recede, it's going to cause havoc with the airline industry, and it's entirely possible that the commercial airline industry as we know it will be gone within 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's got to be a lot of major changes, and of course people tend to be very unconscious about these things. I wanted to say, when we were talking about the foreign policy and the oil and war, that of course most people don't really understand this. I know quite a bit about it, and I was pretty surprised to see that statement, you know, to understand that these other wars were about, you know, these past wars when I was younger and before I was born were also about oil. And so there's always the issue of the media and what people know and what's presented. And certainly in these times, some of us are getting to see that they're just layers and layers and layers of lies.
Yeah. Well, we have a constant propaganda stream in the form of advertising that's encouraging us every day to consume more, to buy more stuff, to buy bigger cars and drive more and so on. And fundamentally, what we really need is the propaganda stream to go in the other direction, to be encouraging us to use less, to travel less, and so on. Because we've created, over the last 200 years of the Industrial Revolution, which has been all about fossil fuels, over this last two centuries, we've created an economy that is based on perpetual growth. And the way we've been able to achieve that constant growth is by constantly having more energy. You know, physicists define energy as the basis of work, that which enables work to be accomplished. So if we have less energy, less work can get done. We cannot continue to grow the economy in the conventional way. Well, we are going to have less energy in the future, no matter whether we make good choices or bad choices. If we make good choices, that will mean conservation and changing to renewables. If we make bad choices, it's basically just war for the rest of our lifetimes and our children's lifetimes. But good choices are bad, there's going to be less net energy to go around. So we have to change our economic activity and reduce our economic activity. That's a very difficult message politically. No politician wants to say that that's what we have to do. But in fact, that's the direction we're headed, whether we like it or not.
Mm-hmm. And I want to say something else, too, about the oil. I mean, basically, this whole culture is swimming in oil. People don't even begin to realize that all these plastic bags and half of our clothes and just everything is oil, oil, oil. Whether we think about it as that, I mean, most of us don't think about it as that. I also want to say that I'm not sure if your birds are coming out on the mic here, but listeners, if you're hearing some sounds in the background, that's what it is. Yes. Hard to make birds be quiet.
Yeah, sorry about that. They're our little friends. Yeah, oil is, as you say, it's the basis for so much of our way of life. Now, there are alternatives we can use for plastics, for example. It can be made from vegetable material and so on. But for many things, there really aren't good alternatives. Mm-hmm. And we should be saving the fossil fuels that we have left, oil and natural gas, for those uses for which there are no good alternatives. Now, just taking fossil fuels and putting them in the tanks of our car and stepping on the gas is probably the worst use of those precious fossil fuels that we could imagine, because they're burned quickly and in huge quantities, and they're gone forever. So we really need to think about that remaining trillion barrels of oil that's in the ground, which will be much more expensive and difficult to get out of the ground than the first trillion barrels. You know, it makes sense. If you're going to extract a resource, you go for the easy stuff first. Well, that's what we've done. And most of the easy, cheap stuff is already gone. So that second trillion barrels is going to be more expensive, more difficult to access, and that's all there is. Once, as we use that up, nature isn't making any more. So we really need to prioritize what we do with the remaining fossil fuels of the planet.
And you say that it uses more, it takes more oil to get that remaining oil, so it becomes not... Right. Not a good investment.
Right. This is you're bringing up a very important subject, which is energy profit ratios. It takes energy to get energy. It takes energy to get oil out of the ground. And historically, oil has been a very good deal. It's taken extraordinarily little energy to explore for and drill and pump oil as compared to the amount of energy we get out of the oil. Oil is a very concentrated source of energy. So as we look at the alternatives to oil, we have to think in terms of energy profit ratios. And some alternatives don't have a very good energy profit ratio. For example, nuclear. When you look at the amount of energy required to build nuclear plants, mine and process uranium and transport it, and then operate the plant, and store the radioactive waste, and then decommission the nuclear plant, all of those activities are very energy intensive. If you add all that together, the energy profit ratio for nuclear is probably in the range of 3 or 4 to 1, as opposed to the 50 to 100 to 1 historically of oil. So nuclear is not a very good alternative just from the standpoint of energy profit ratios. There are also a lot of other reasons that we shouldn't be moving toward nuclear, the unsolved problem of radioactive waste disposal and so on. But an alternative like wind, for example, has a much better energy profit ratio than nuclear does. So of the available energy alternatives, I think wind is probably one of the better ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got solar panels in California here. We have a rebate, and I thought, well, given the way things are going, I better get them like sooner rather than later, because for one thing, they're expensive, and that rebate won't be around long since the government is just withdrawing money from everything useful, only, you know, using it for killing people, basically, and making the rich richer. So, but, you know, it must take a lot of energy to make those solar panels. And I'm plugged into the grid. I guess you probably have solar panels too, Richard Heinberg.
Yeah. We have solar panels on our house, and I drive a car that runs on biofuels, on biodiesel. And these are things that we can do now to make a change. Now, we also have to think systemically. Now, in terms of our entire transportation system, biodiesel doesn't make much sense. We just can't produce enough biodiesel to run our entire fleet of cars.
That's vegetable oil, right?
Right.
From fast food places?
Yeah, it's basically modified vegetable oil. I mean, as long as we have this unused resource of used recycled vegetable oil, sure, let's turn it into fuel and run as many diesel-powered vehicles on it as we can. But we have to think in terms of the system as a whole. And when we do that, we realize basically what we need to do is just travel a lot less, reduce our transportation, create more public transportation systems, and use much more energy-efficient, smaller vehicles. In Europe, they sell a car called the Lupo. Volkswagen makes it, and it gets about 90 miles to the gallon. So that's at least 50% better than the typical hybrid car that's in the U.S., which is currently our most efficient commercial vehicle, which gets about 50 miles to the gallon. So there's a tremendous amount of room for improvement there.
And we really people really need to start thinking. Your book, Richard Heinberg, "The Party's Over: Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Society." So that party was what the last or not even give the years of the party.
Well, the industrial era really started in the 18th century with the beginning use of coal, but really the 20th century when we began to use oil is really party time in terms of the massive increase in industrialism. And, you know, this tracks very closely with global population. World population was about 1 billion in 1800 in the early years of the Industrial Revolution. And using fossil fuels, we were able to increase the human carrying capacity of the planet by about 600%. There were 2 billion of us in 1930, 3 billion in 1960, 4 billion by 1975, 5 billion in the 1980s, 6 billion by 1998, and 1998 wasn't that long ago, and we've already added more than a third of a billion people just since 1998. Well, the way we've been able to do this is with fossil fuels, transporting resources from where they're abundant to where they're scarce, creating chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides. And this is a very serious problem, because as the fossil fuels go away, will we be able to support this many people? It's very doubtful, actually.
Yeah. In fact, I think that you mentioned how many people you think are going to die if we don't do something about it, like really drastic. And it takes really government policies in addition to individual awareness. And we don't have much of either of those, in fact.
Yeah, it's very sad. We have created a global economic system that encourages dependence on this centralized system of based on fossil fuels. And people who formerly were independent of that system, peasant farmers, subsistence farmers, are constantly being thrown off their land and forced into the system. We need to reverse that process. We need to reverse globalization, create redundance and independence and subsistence wherever we can. Because those are the lifeboats. That's the path towards survival into the 22nd century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I notice. I mean, people just don't think about it at all. And in terms of food, I've a while ago started really paying attention to not eating food that's from far away. We're lucky enough to have farmers markets around here. I don't know how many people who are listening have that option where people bring things. And they still have to bring it by trucks, of course, unless right. They grow the food. I mean, we need to grow food right where we are as much as possible. And certainly not be bringing, you know, thinking that we have to have, if you live in a cold place, tomatoes in the middle of winter and all these, and canning. I mean, I just want to tell people, start thinking. Think. Become aware of the fuel, the oil that is not only constitutes some of the things, many of the things around us, but how the transportation takes. It's quite mind-blowing. It's really mind-blowing. So, Richard Heinberg, go on with your positive alternatives, because I know there's a lot of talk about hydrogen, and you seem to think wind is the best thing, and then there's water.
Well, hydrogen, I think, is going to be useful for niche applications. I have to say I'm not nearly as optimistic about hydrogen as the basis for a future economy as some other people are. The reason for that is that hydrogen isn't an energy source. It's just an energy storage medium. And the inefficiency of converting our basic energy sources first into hydrogen and then back into electricity to use for transportation and various other uses, those inefficiencies are considerable. Storage of hydrogen is a problem. Hydrogen, because it's such a small molecule, will actually, you know, leaks through most containers, and the leakage is considerable. Perhaps 5% of hydrogen in a typical storage tank will leak out each day. The technical problems just have not been solved. And so far, the comprehensive studies that have been done on hydrogen as a basic fuel for transportation and other important uses suggest that it's not likely to serve us as well as, again, the rosy optimists are suggesting. So what we're really left with are the alternatives we already know about: solar, wind, hydro, and micro-hydro. We're just going to have to make the most of those, which means investing huge amounts, probably trillions of dollars over the next years, literally trillions of dollars, in transforming our energy infrastructure from fossil fuels to these alternatives. Right now, we're spending $400 billion a year in this country on the military. we need to be spending at least that much on the energy transition. And I would suggest that, that the sooner we make that spending transition from military to energy, the better off we will be and the better off the world will be. Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. I mean, I think most people think, oh, well, we'll just have electric cars. I mean, they don't think, well, where's electricity going to come from? You know, and a lot of, and people often think, well, the government's going to, you know, going to take care of it. And so what do you think are the chances of that happening? Or what do you think? I guess we need to organize the usual thing.
Right, right. Well, I think optimism is the only functional attitude to have. Now, you know, rationally, looking at the situation, one has to say we are headed for some difficult times ahead because our whole way of life is going to change, whether we like it or not, and whether we handle it intelligently or not. But if we do handle it intelligently, I think a century from now we could be living in a world where producers and consumers are much closer together, where people are living a slower-paced way of life, a more psychologically satisfying way of life, where communities are smaller and more revitalized, people live closer to their food source, have more of a sense of competence and self-sufficiency. I think this could be good for the earth. It could be good for us. But again, in order for that to happen, we're going to have to respond intelligently to this challenge. And this, I have to say, is the biggest challenge that we have faced in our history as a species. And that's, I'm not overstating the problem, because there are 6 billion of us right now. And for 6 billion of us to make this transition is going to require a tremendous amount of coordination and planning, sharing of the resources that are left. And so far, we haven't been very good at that. So we're going to have to develop some new social skills as well as some new engineering skills to make this transition.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, we do have some models from a long time ago. And from some people, there's still some indigenous people, if they're not getting knocked off by the oil companies.
Yeah, that even Cuba, you know, was cut off from oil supplies by the Soviet Union as the Soviet Union collapsed not that many years ago. And they have managed to make this transition in many respects in a very good way. So I think Cuba maybe is not a good example in some respects in terms of political repression and so on. But in terms of the way they have made this energy transition, I think we could learn a lot from them.
Mm-hmm. Bicycles, for one thing.
That's right.
Okay, well, I hope we've gotten people to think a little bit here, because everything, it starts with consciousness. Thank you so much for this book, Richard Heinberg, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and you can get it at most bookstores, so do get it.
Yeah, look for it at your local independent bookstore. Thank you so much, Sue.
And what's your website?
My website is www.museletter.com.
Great. Okay, thanks so much. Hi, everybody. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Richard Heinberg, and my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.